All right, good morning. House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is 1:12 a.m. on Saturday, April 21st, 2012. I appreciate everybody's indulgence for being here on a Saturday. Let the record reflect that members of the House Resources Committee are present. Representative Herron, Representative Gardner, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Dick, Representative Munoz, Rep. Foster, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Wilson, myself, Co-Chair Feige. We're joined today by the House Special Committee on Energy, Representative Pruitt, if you would introduce your members.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We've got Representative Sadler with us, Representative Peterson, Representative Lynn, Representative Olson, you already mentioned Co-Chair Foster, but then myself, Co-Chair Pruitt.
Okay, thanks. And in the audience today, some other legislators present, Senator Giesel, Representative Dugan, and Representative Keller. So welcome once again. Purpose of meeting today is to continue. I'm sorry, Representative Tuck is online. He's not on a beach, is he?
I wish.
Okay. The purpose of our meeting today is to continue the discussion of the issues surrounding our consideration of House Bill 3001, Oil and Gas Production Tax, by the governor. This morning we'll have presentations by the Department of Revenue, once again Commissioner Brian Butcher and Deputy Commissioner Bruce Tangeman, followed by presentations from Division of Oil and Gas, Director Bill Barron, and he'll be accompanied by AOGCC Commissioner John Norman. Questions from legislators in the audience will be accepted in writing. Comments, anyone? Richie? Anyone? No? All right. Commissioner Butcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committees. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. And what we'd like to do today is just take you through a short PowerPoint presentation that kind of gives a little bit of context to the issue. I know yesterday we went through the nuts and bolts of the bill and began kind of laying out what it is we're doing, but now we'd like to just kind of show a little bit of context about where we see the state of Alaska compared to other areas, and just a general context to the presentation of the bill. To discuss the conversation, as I'm sure most of you are aware, oil prices have been at all-time highs for several years now. For many decades, we bounced around between the teens, the 20s, to the 30s. It dropped a couple of times into single digits. It would occasionally pop up into the 40s. But once it moved up into the 50s, 60s, we've now seen it at 100 or above 100 now for quite a period of time. And most experts see this as kind of the new reality, what we're looking for going forward, at least for the next 10 years in the world. That can certainly change, but that's the view of experts today. What we've seen as a result, as a direct result of the higher prices, is projects that weren't economic at $30 a barrel, $35 a barrel, obviously are much more likely to be economic at $100 a barrel, or $110, or $90. And that, along with technological improvements, has resulted in big booms occurring all over the world. Focusing specifically on North America, we're seeing it in Alberta, we're seeing it in North Dakota, we're seeing it in Texas, some of the smaller producing states, Wyoming, Louisiana. We seem to be seeing it just about everywhere but the state of Alaska. According to the federal government and United States Geological Survey, it's not a resource issue. The Department of Revenue also agrees with that, and I won't spend too much time on this slide because I know we've got DNR coming up behind us, but the federal government doesn't even consider the North Slope a mature basin in the last report they did. Over 70% of state land has been minimally explored, and I think Mr. Tangeman touched on it a little bit yesterday that when Prudhoe Bay was discovered, it was such a massive reservoir, unlike anything that had been found in North America, that all the exploration In other areas, Cook Inlet flooded there because there was such a massive volume of oil. It made more sense to put your exploration, your investment there than it would other places for obvious reasons. There was a definite known amount of oil up there. But there's no debating among anybody you talk to, and once again, DNR will be discussing this, that Alaska is a world-class energy basin. Cumulatively, the production from the North Slope through 2010 has been 16 billion barrels. There's also estimated to be 40 billion barrels of conventional oil up there. These are estimates. It could be more. It could be less. We don't know. And this includes offshore OCS, by the way. Gas, we're estimated to have 236 trillion cubic feet of conventional natural gas, a tremendous amount. In fact, every day there is between eight and a half billion cubic feet of gas recycled into the field in the largest gas circulating facility in the world. It recirculates about the same amount of gas that the country of Canada uses on a daily basis. So it just gives you an idea of the tremendous resource we have up there. And as a result, as you're all aware, that's why there's been so much focus on the development of a big gas pipeline for export, whether it's to Alberta or now more focused on potential export from Tidewater to Asian markets. There's also tens of billions of barrels of heavy and viscous oil. Most of it that we know of exists underneath the giant Prudhoe Bay field. Estimated to be 40 billion barrels there. How much of it is recoverable? At this point, it's not economic right now to develop. When it does, is a quarter of that going to be developed? Is half of it? It's new. It's just evolving, and we don't know to what degree we're going to be able to get that oil out of the ground, but there's a lot of potential there. There's also billions of barrels of shale oil. As well as shale gas that we've talked about. There's three huge shale formations on the North Slope along the level of the Bakken Shale in North Dakota. It's giant. We don't know a lot about it. We don't know if it can be developed. We don't know if it is, if it can be developed, if it can be developed sooner, or whether we don't have the technology and it'll happen later. But there's definitely a lot. There's reason to be happy, reason to be excited about the future for Alaska and the natural resources we have on the North Slope. Also, Mr. Chairman, as a state, we're in a position we've never been in before. We're able to look back and see with a lot higher degree of understanding what's happened in the oil patch than we had previously. When we switched from a gross tax where we simply taxed the amount of oil being produced, the price of the oil, and then a certain tax, we didn't have as great an understanding of what's going on up there as we do now. Since we've moved to a net, since the operating expenses and capital expenses of companies factor in to our tax equation, we now are collecting a lot more information than we ever have before. And that's something that the Department of Revenue has been working on really in a lot more detail starting last summer to come up with a lot more defined ideas of specifically what's going on so not only we know at the department, but policymakers can be made aware of that to help your decision-making process as well. Taking a look at what we're looking at today compared to what we've looked at in previous years, looking through PPT and looking through ACES, it was a situation of running a lot of modeling, a lot of forecasting, a lot of projections. We didn't know as much about what was going on up there, and we're in a situation where fortunately we do have a lot better idea over the last 5 years of what has been occurring. And so what that leads to, as I mentioned in the previous slide, is record high oil prices leading to employment booms, investment booms, production booms, all over the world. As we mentioned briefly yesterday, Russia and ExxonMobil have worked out an agreement that they hope to potentially invest up to $500 billion on offshore Arctic in Russia. And the result of that was Russia reducing its taxes, eliminating its export tax to a level below where we are in the state of Alaska. And that has resulted in this potential explosion of investment in the Arctic in Russia. As a result of that, the Russian government and the Russian government oil companies are pairing with Exxon to do this development, where the Russian companies are taking about two-thirds of the work, with ExxonMobil taking one-third. In exchange, the Russian company will have pieces of Exxon's work in the Gulf of Mexico, in Alberta, in Texas, not in Alaska.
Commissioner Representative Calza.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually had questions on the first slide, slide two. And I have a handful of questions to ask, so, and I hope I don't repeat the questions.
It would be more appropriate to wait till the end of the presentation. Perhaps he's going to answer your questions in the course of this presentation.
We could do it that way, but I'll just have a series of questions at the end of the presentation. I think it's more appropriate that we have the dialogue going forward while the slides freshen people's minds.
Go ahead with your question,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On bullet two, okay, bullet one, I don't think I've got any argument about that. I think we have seen some all-time highs in oil, and also that it seems forecasts are correct that oil will be an expensive commodity in years to come, even despite economic issues worldwide. But the second bullet, dealing with producing regions, I know has been pointed out several times, and it was pointed out before this committee yesterday, but it was sort of glazed over. I'd like to know, for the producing regions that you mentioned, Alberta, North Dakota, Texas, how many of those oil-producing regions are enjoying the employment and production booms because of technology versus what we've got is just a large, mature, conventional oil field? Because I think that is a big point. Not only does it take more people to build a small hydraulic fracture type facility, but it's also, I think it's, so you'll have more employees, but I think that we've also seen a higher level of production specifically due to technology and not necessarily changes in taxes that Department of Revenue is talking about. Can you address that first question?
Sure, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. Certainly the technological advances play a role in that, but the price of oil and the tax level and the, a number of issues, the ease in which they can get to fields, the small cost and turnaround in the lower 48 compared to the state of Alaska all plays roles in that. As an example, in North Dakota, technological advancements allowed it to be economic at $70 to $80. However, with our tax structure in North Dakota, it would not be economic at $70 or $80. And the same thing is with Alberta. With Texas, they're now having an explosion of shale oil. However, when they flattened out their decline and began to turn it around, that was exclusively having to do with conventional oil. And the price making things more economic combined, obviously, with the fact that it's much cheaper to produce oil in Texas, and the turnaround from exploration to production is a year to a couple of years as opposed to 7 to 10 years, as we see in the state of Alaska.
Okay, again, I want the answer to be perfectly clear. So I'll try to clarify my question is, how much of the oil in the new producing regions that you just noted in Texas, in Eagle Ford and Bakken Shale, are due to technological advances versus mature fields and conventional oil? And if you don't have those numbers, and if it's a question that we should ask Division of Oil and Gas, I will do that.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it's not a yes or no answer. It's not this has happened only because of the price of oil, or this has occurred only because of technology, or only because of low taxes or high taxes. It's a combination of all of those things.
And how much oil? I have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Then hold your thought, Representative.
Thank you, and I guess my question kind of related to this. I mean, you're painting a picture that we're not getting investment here because of low prices previously, mature basin. You said that the federal government does not declare this as a mature basin, yet in 2004 we had a price of 45, which is the highest we'd ever had. We did not see the exploration, did not see the development wells being drilled by the existing producers that were in control of those fields. And so when you were seeing historic high prices, you were seeing not the development, not the reinvestment in Alaska. In 2005, we again had historic high prices at $60 a barrel, and we didn't see that, and the tax rate basically was between 0 and 5%. So I guess the picture you're trying to paint is that we don't have any investment here in this field when prices are high, but when we did have high prices and we had very low taxes, we didn't have that either. So I guess I'm concerned that we paint this picture that everything is caused by ACEs when we didn't have a net profit tax, when we had a zero tax, we didn't get the investment that you were talking about, and so I would like to find that out.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we have a slide a little bit further on that we kind of show the curves for the major oil-producing regions in North America compared to the price of oil, that you can kind of see it. But certainly, as I've just said, taxes are a major piece. It's not the entire piece. There's a big difference between $100 oil for a sustained period of time and $45 oil, as well as the high cost. Alaska might be, it's certainly one of, if not the highest place, most expensive place to do business in the world. So we have a hurdle rate for economics much higher than the places that our competitors we would talk about in North America, that have a much shorter turnaround. And certainly DNR can speak to this. The cost of an exploration well is much smaller. And so there's a lot of other factors that play into it when a company is going forward and making a decision whether to explore, whether to develop. And unfortunately, most of those things aren't on Alaska's side when you compare them to other areas.
I'd just like to
follow up, Representative.
Yeah, I'd like you to submit to the committee the details on internal hurdle rates that are higher for Alaska, because normally hurdle rates are internal rates of return, which include the expenditures that are going to cost to get there and what the return on capital is. So if you have data that you can show that the companies that are here have higher hurdle rates, internal rates of return for their Alaska operations versus the operations in the lower 48, please submit this to us.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, so speaking specifically of a company that's looking at doing business, I mean, if you're looking at a more mature development like Prudhoe Bay, obviously what a company's looking at today is different than what they'd be looking at if they were looking to explore or looking to develop new areas.
Your statement is that the companies here have higher hurdle rates than they do outside. I want you to document that for the committee. That the hurdle rates that are used for Alaska internal rates of return are higher than they are for other areas. I just want you to provide us that
information. Okay, we'll provide you what we can. And to clarify the point I was making is that the cost of doing business, the expense of doing business, is more in Alaska than it is in anywhere else in North America, certainly.
Okay, Commissioner Fontaine. And we'll hold questions till the end, because there's obviously a lot of material in here. I'm just going to answer some of those questions.
I have a quick question that can be answered later or even tomorrow. I mean, I just want to put it on the record because it's relevant to what we're discussing. And that is, can you, Mr. Chair, you always ask me to ask questions quickly, and I do ask questions quickly.
I know.
And I'd appreciate it if you didn't say it every time I ask the question. Thank you. Can you give us some examples today, tomorrow, whenever, of specific locations where there is a boom in mature conventional basins as measured by increased investment and a change in the decline curve? I think that kind of gets to the heart of what we've both been discussing here. Thank you.
Okay. Please continue, Commissioner.
This is a slide that certainly we've all seen before, and which has been what we've looked at is the decline curve for Alaska, beginning the decline in 1989 when we were a little over 2 million barrels a day, down to under 600,000 barrels today. In fact, I believe in the last week or so, North Dakota may have passed us as a oil-producing state. We'll talk a little bit about this. The only reason it popped into my mind is I know that I got emailed from North Dakota that they had just passed 600,000 barrels. So, This is the problem we're trying to solve, production, trying to get production to flatten out and ultimately get production to turn around. This slide, and I know it's a little busy, that's why I tried to show Alaska in the previous slide, shows the major oil-producing jurisdictions in North America, Texas, Alaska, North Dakota, Alberta, and then we've layered in the price of WTI. As you can see, and just to point out, just for information's sake, North Dakota is down along the bottom. Once the oil started, price started to shoot up in the mid-2000, you see they began going back up. That was a combination of the technological advances of shale and certainly the price getting to a point where shale oil development was economic. It was previously not economic below $70 or $80 a barrel. You can see Alberta, which kind of bounces around over the decades and then begins an up and is going to be steepening its incline over the next number of years as the price of oil has gone up. Interestingly, the state of Alaska is the blue line. The state of Texas, which has been producing oil 80 years longer than the state of Alaska has, is the yellow line. And about 1990, when we peaked, Texas was coming down on its decline, and we met up. As you can see, our decline curves over the decades were almost identical until the price of oil in the mid-2000s took off. At that point, you can see Texas flattening out. And in 2010, it begins to turn the decline curve around. This is almost 100% through conventional oil. I believe in 2010, which is the last year that we have on this chart, they had about 1,000 barrels a day, maybe less than that, of shale oil. So this was entirely conventional oil. Once it got to the high prices, it became more economic, it got developed, and they began to turn that around. As you can see, the state of Alaska continues on the same decline curve that Texas and Alaska had both previously been on. It's interesting to see, as we've talked about, you know, mature basins or what are described as mature basins and decline curves that some have said can't be turned around hasn't been the case in Texas. And of course, shale oil, as we look into 2011 and 2012 and on, the Eagle Ford Basin is going to make a huge turn of this curve. They're looking at adding 300,000, 500,000 barrels a day per year as they begin to develop that field. So we're not going to be anywhere near Texas anytime soon. But we lay this out just to show that what has occurred in the major oil-producing basins as a result of the high price of oil. Like we've talked about previously, technology plays a role. The cost of developing a field, the time of developing a field plays a role. But you can see the effect that it seems to have on every other basin of the big ones, with the exception of the state of Alaska.
Commissioner, has Texas done anything? What is the nature of their taxation system?
Has it
changed much?
Mr. Chairman, it hasn't changed at all. They're relatively high compared to other states that have very little oil production, relatively low compared to the state of Alaska. North Dakota is working on trying to reduce their oil taxes. It's kind of funny. We were there in we visited North Dakota for a couple of days and met with their government and met with a few of their companies there that were developing. And North Dakota had been under the impression that they were the highest oil taxes in the country. They are the highest oil taxes in the continental United States, but somebody in one of our meetings handed an article from the Bismarck, I think it was the Bismarck newspaper, that day that they had done an article. Somebody had done an article talking about oil tax reform in North Dakota, saying that whatever the current price was that day and with progressivity in Alaska, it really has an effect. That for North Dakota to get to Alaska's taxes, they would have to double their tax rate and add 25%. And so that kind of gave, at least at that point in time, an idea to North Dakotans on what they were paying and what was going on in the state of Alaska. Interestingly enough, one of the 2 days we were there, the legislature was having a meeting on, the House Majority Leader has a bill there trying to reduce the tax rate based on the increase of barrels of oil in the state of North Dakota, that the higher the production is, the lower the tax rate would go, which is the exact opposite of the state of Alaska. And their thinking was the higher it gets, the state government only needs a certain amount of money to run, and the higher it gets, the less of a percentage the state needs to run, and they were concerned that their state government would get to such a size that when the oil began to run out, the small population of North Dakota would be unable to be taxed to the level to afford their government. Now, I'm not suggesting we go opposite of progressivity at all, but it was a very interesting conversation to sit in and listen to, because it was much different than what we've talked about here, and it's just they're going through a boom very similar to what we went through in the 70s. They can't find enough housing. You get a $5,000 signing bonus and if you commit to 1 year working as a manager at McDonald's, and it's just kind of the wild times that we saw here, but they're trying to figure out a way to try to get some control over it.
Commissioner, on North Dakota's curve there about 1979-80 when the price spiked, there's really no increase in production there, but as the price rises starting about 2002-2003, all of a sudden you see sort of a ski jump there at the end. Why is that?
Well, I think, and companies can probably describe it better, certainly the advancement of technology played a big role, but also it's the difference between where the price of oil has gone and what the economic models of companies run in terms of what they think it's going to be. As an example, when the price of oil got up to $147 a barrel, it hit there briefly. It then plummeted down around $40 a barrel. Well, no company would be making their decision on $140 barrel oil, even if it were to go for a number of months. It takes a while to get to a point where a company would decide that, as an example, $100 barrel oil is here to stay. 6 months of $100 barrel oil is not going to change their initial models, which were based on $30 to $40 or $40 to $50, and they can explain better, you know, kind of how long it takes to turn the ship around when you're used to a certain way of thinking. You certainly don't want to decide, okay, we're now going to move forward economically on the idea that we're at $100 a barrel oil, have it go down to $30 a barrel for 2 or 3 years, and be moving forward on a project that once it starts production will be producing at a deficit.
Representative Seaton, a question on the slide.
Yeah, and you're talking about Texas improving so much over Alaska's rate of decline because of prices of oil, and yet the separation is anywhere between 1997 and 2001, and of course the price of a barrel of oil was $20. It wasn't, you know, where the separation and changes occurred don't correspond at all to price changes in oil. So if those two lines diverge and it's based on something else, what else is that? Because it's not based on the price of oil.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't know the answer to that question. You can see it bounce back and forth where we go above Texas and then below Texas, but it wasn't until the last 5 or 6 years that it very obviously split out, where one state very obviously stopped the decline and turned it around where one continued, and that's what we've been focusing on.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to follow up. It seems like if you're going to use this slide to say that the declines started, the separation occurred in 1999 or 2000 or something, and the decline curve separated, and you can't use the argument that it was the price of oil, then I would hope that you'd come back to us and check with them and find out whether it was technological advances, whether it was change in investment climates, what it was that we're doing. Because we can't just start attributing parts of the slide that we want to factors that are, you know, obviously not related to where the separation occurs. So appreciate that.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we'll look into that, but you see it separate but it comes back together. And by 2005, it's very close, like it had been previously. So there is a reason why we dipped and then plateaued in the early 2001, 2002, and they did a little bit, and we can look into that, but ultimately it ends up closing back up again.
As I said before, please hold your questions until the end.
If others are asking questions, I think it's appropriate for me to also ask questions on this slide.
Yes, but I'm the chairman, Representative. Please continue, Mr. Commissioner.
Under protest, Mr. Chair.
Duly noted.
As Mr. Tangeman brought up briefly yesterday, there are two distinct elements of ACES, the tax credits and the production tax. And as we discussed, as we talked with various companies, there seemed to be a difference in how they viewed ACES based on kind of where they were in the timeline from exploration to production. ACES, as we know, has very generous tax credits. So if you're a new company that comes in, you're looking to explore, the state of Alaska reimburses anywhere from estimate 45 to 65% of what you spend. So there's real incentive for a company to get out and to kind of get to the initial phases of exploring and developing oil. When they transition, and companies have told us this as well, to the point in which they want to move to production, they want to move to actually producing the oil, these smaller companies, these wildcatters that come in that were attracted to the tax credits, have difficulty finding larger companies to work with them to produce, to actually produce the tax. Because most of these wildcatters, whether they buy leases, explore, and then find oil and sell the lease to a larger company or go in with another company on another lease, it's at that point that they're having difficulty moving forward because our tax rate is so much higher than what they see in virtually any other, certainly part of any other part of North America, as well as any other OECD country with the exception of Norway. And so that's where we see the disconnect in trying to do something to increase the investment, increase the development, and ultimately the production in the state. As you look at the lines for ELF, for PPT, and for ACES, which is the history of where we've been in the last 7 or 8 years in the state of Alaska, the purple bar is what the estimated revenue for the next 4 years based on the Department of Revenue's production forecast and price forecast. As you can see with ELF, the state of Alaska wasn't getting anywhere near its fair share. It's certainly a tax system that needed to be overhauled. Taxes need to be raised. And as you can see with PPT, they were raised. The light blue bar is what we'd be bringing in if we were still under PPT. The yellow bar is what we would be bringing in if we were under ACES as proposed. And then the red bar is what we would be bringing in, is what we're bringing in currently if we leave the current law in. And the difference between ACES and proposed and ACES as passed occurred near the end of the special session on ACES, where the progressivity was made much more aggressive than it was in the bill that had been originally proposed by the governor. And as you can see, that's a sizable jump between what we looked at with the PPT and what we looked at as ACES has proposed. We see that as kind of where the state went up a little higher than they should have gone, and coming back to a level more representative of the ACES as proposed makes more sense to us at the Department of Revenue. And I wish I had the current bill that's just been drafted on here. We can certainly provide the committee with this chart when we've had the opportunity to put that in. But you're going to see the bar for this bill being right around the level of the blue and the yellow, down to where ACES is, similar to where ACES is proposed was. Slide 9, Mr. Chairman, is just to make a point as kind of a caveat on taking a look at what oil prices have done over the last 5.5, 6 years. Even though we've been over $100 a barrel now for the last almost year, and we project it to be over $100 a barrel, the fact remains, if you go back to the beginning of fiscal year 07 to today, over 70% of that time we've been under $100 a barrel. So to believe that because we've been for a year or so over $100 a barrel that we should expect that's always where we're going to be is ignoring the past, because that's something that could certainly be in our very near future or at some point in our future. Also, and we all remember when it jumped up, as you can see, in 2008 to up to $140 a barrel, it very quickly nosedived within a few months down just under $40 a barrel, and there's a number of reasons for that. But one of the main reasons for that was there was a worldwide contraction in the economy at that point. Because at $140 a barrel, different decisions are made than would normally be made. And at that point, OPEC certainly made it very vocal that they recognized that $140 a barrel was detrimental to the world economy, and that's not a place they would ever want to go again. And so it just reminds us of the volatility of oil, that as the price of oil continues to go up, there's certainly negative, positive consequences to the Treasury. There's negative consequences to Alaska, particularly in rural Alaska, Fairbanks. But it also has real detrimental potential effects to the U.S. economy, to the world economy, that could send prices plummeting. So it's a very volatile world we're looking at. And because it's been fairly constant over the last year or so, doesn't mean that the same factors in play that have bounced things around in the past couldn't happen to us in the future.
Thank you, Commissioner. We've received a question. Representative Kawasaki.
Oh, gosh. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we were on slide two. Again, I wanted to restate the question. And the question was dealing with on the oil-producing regions, North Dakota, Alberta, and Texas that you mentioned, a way to simplify the question and get us a simplified answer will be how much of the new incremental oil is from technological advances versus conventional oil well drills? Can you get us that?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I can get you I think I can get you a breakdown of what comes from conventional and what comes from shale. And then we'll work to get that to the committee.
Hey, Representative Garner.
Hi. On slide number six, you stated that the Texas increase is almost entirely mature basins. And yet, the Institute of Energy Research disagrees, using information from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. They say Texas produced 1,427,000 barrels a day in 2011, 22% more than in 2010, the highest amount of production since 1997, and the increase is primarily from the Eagle Ford shale formation. That's not conventional oil. So I would like to see some really specific examples of any mature conventional fields anywhere that have seen a boom, because Eagle Ford is not conventional oil.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I mentioned when we showed this slide that it cuts off at 2010 and that there was next to no shale oil produced in 2010. In 2011, which isn't on here, it does shoot up, and I had mentioned that. It shoots up by a few hundred thousand barrels, and it continues into 2012. We'll be happy to give you a year-by-year breakdown of shale oil production from the Eagle Ford Shale, which is where the vast majority, almost entirely, of the shale oil is coming from Texas. And you're going to see that until 2011, it was very low to almost zero, but we don't factor it in on the slide.
So it isn't accurate that the Texas increase is almost entirely mature basins.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, it's accurate that it flattened out and turned around and began to incline almost entirely from conventional oil. The huge incline you're seeing in 11 and 12, which aren't on here, is as a result of shale oil, and I pointed that out as when we were on the slide.
Okay, thank you.
President Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question still on this slide. Actually came from a conversation that we had afterwards with actually Representative Seaton yesterday after our meeting yesterday. What I'm trying to understand with North Dakota, we talk a lot about North Dakota and the increase in North Dakota, but I want to make sure that there's that I fully understand. We know that their tax rate is considerably less. What is the full take? That includes the private royalties. If it's now become economically feasible that they can draw some of that out where before they couldn't, how are they able to do that if there's a 30% royalty or whatever it may be, whatever the private royalty is? I'm just trying to kind of wrap my arms around that. I hope that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we can get that information to you. We put together a report that came out in January on different tax regimes. And we can get a breakdown between the two. Basically, the tax in North Dakota is 6.5% up to $50, and then above $50, it takes it up to about 11%. The royalty really varies. It tends to be 10% to 20% on some of the fields that have been developed a longer period of time, and a good percentage of the Bakken is included in that because it was already producing conventional oil, a very small percentages. Some of the newer ones have been up higher at 25%, maybe even 30%. So that certainly does factor into what it is they're doing. Of course, like we've talked about before, you have to factor in a lot of the other pieces of it, which is, and we certainly witnessed it firsthand. In fact, my brother-in-law, who used to work heavy machinery up here, is working in the oil fields in North Dakota right now. You can drive right. In fact, he stays about 500 yards away from where he works, because you can drive right off the two-lane road and park there. So it gives you an idea of the many variables that you have to take into account when you're trying to compare different states, different provinces. And that's why we came out with the report we did on oil tax regimes, because it's so difficult. It's easy to put a slide up and say, look, Iraq's taxing up here, Indiana's taxing down here, but what does that really mean? What does that mean? Indiana doesn't produce any oil, so what difference does it make? And Iraq's got profit share, or has got production share contracts, and an entirely different way of producing their oil than we do, and is that appropriate? So we tried to get to a point where we could try to make more of an apples-to-apples comparison, and so we'll do what we can to kind of get a side-by-side that's easier to understand.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a couple of questions. First of all, let's go back to slide number 4. And, Commissioner, you had mentioned that we now have actual information, and so we have the luxury to look back and see what actually happened over the past 5 years. But then I asked you about information from the audits, and you said we actually haven't completed all of those yet. Matter of fact, we still have most of 5 years left to complete. And I think it would be good information for us to have to see what tax credits are being used and for what those credits are for, so that we can see whether that part of ACES is working as well as we had anticipated it would. And I was just wondering, is there any way to get, I know you said it's proprietary information, I'm just wondering, is there any information that you could get us to help us make some of these decisions we need to make?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, absolutely. We'd be happy to provide you capital spending, operating spending. This is something that we have a lot more detail on than we ever had before we switched to a net tax. When analyzing how well tax credits are working, that's a much more difficult issue. And let me explain kind of the two pieces of it. There are companies that are claiming tax credits that have no production, that are out exploring, and then there are companies that are currently producing that have tax credits. Well, for the companies that are receiving tax credits that are currently exploring, we're not going to know for years what we get out of that. So if you're a company and you come in this year and you start and you spend a certain amount of money and we give you a tax credit, hopefully in 7 years or in 10 years you're going to start producing and then we're going to have an answer. But we're not likely to have an answer anytime soon on definitively where that's going to go. If we can gather that information based on what's occurred in the last 4 or 5 years, we'll see what we can do. In terms of the companies and that are currently producing, trying to draw a line between what they did as a result of the tax credits and what they would not have done as a result of the tax credits, I think that's something that we don't have that kind of detailed separation on now. Companies may be able to provide that, but it's a very difficult situation because they're already producing a tremendous amount.
Okay. Follow up?
Just a second. Of the companies that have taken the ACES tax credits for exploration and sort of the process of going out and trying to develop a field, we've had ACES now since 2007, so we're coming up on about 5 years. How many of those companies have made a decision to go forward with actual production?
Mr. Chairman, that would be a good question for DNR. I hate to pass the buck to Mr. Barron, but he would probably be able to give you a better idea of what's happening in the oil patch. We're always fairly limited on what we can say because this is all taxpayer information and it's confidential, and we can talk about tax credits as a whole, but in terms of a specific company and what taxes they pay and what their tax credits are, that's not something that we can
speak. You're restricted by statute from telling me about specific companies.
That is correct. Companies could certainly come forward, but we can't. Just like you can tell somebody what's in your tax return, but the federal government had better not do it or they're breaking the law.
Sure, Mr. Barron's in the back taking notes. Representative Peterson, please. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on slide 7, you were talking about the difficulty of some of the new wildcatters, you call them, switching from exploration to production, and that you thought that the tax might be one of the impediments that was stopping them from moving to production. But I've actually read that one of the big impediments is access to facilities, whether it be processing facilities or the pipeline itself. And I was wondering if you would make a comment about that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Peterson. Once again, facilities access is a DNR issue more than a DOR issue. I know the last two fields to come on were done by smaller producers, and in the limited conversations I've had with them, they said they didn't have any difficulty getting into the field. But like I said, that's a DNR issue. They'd be able to enlighten you a little bit more.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Olson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Butcher, when you mentioned slide 8, that you could redo it with 3001, could you also do it with North Dakota?
Yeah, we could, through the chair, Representative Olson. Let me see what we can do on that. It's like I said, it's a different... It's a different beast, but let me see if there's something that we can do to kind of, if we were to have their structure in place with our production and our price estimates, what that would show. Maybe we can do that. We'll try.
Thank you very much.
On that point, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I think that the conversation's been around contractor take, and so if we just show government take, which would exclude the private royalty, it wouldn't give us any information that would be valuable to us if we're trying to compare the competitiveness of us versus the other regime. So I'd appreciate it if you'd include that as well. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative, I was thinking about that too, and you're absolutely right. If we didn't include that, it would be pretty invalid. And if I could tell one interesting story about North Dakota, Mr. Chairman.
We got time.
Okay. Very interesting in North Dakota is people that have owned these farms for hundreds of years, decades, and some of them have had relatives that have sold the subsurface rights, and some of them haven't. And so the footprint for the fracking is actually pretty small. And so you've got this little gravel pad that's producing all this oil, and they're still working the fields around it. But there are people that have a farm on one side that they're making $30,000 a year renting that area to an oil company because they don't own the subsurface rights, and the neighbor across the street still owns the subsurface rights, they're getting $30,000 a year and a cut, 20% or 15% or 25%. They're making $1 million a year plus $30,000, and it's actually created enemies of long-time close families in rural North Dakota, all based on some selling of subsurface rights decades ago that they might not have even realized about. So it's very fascinating to see how fortunate and unfortunate farmers that were in the same place economically just a couple of years ago.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is just kind of a follow-up on what Representative Pruitt was asking about some of the other major tax regimes. You said you'd provide a report. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe put that into a maybe an easy-to-read, some of the major elements type of chart so that we can make those comparisons. I know you had mentioned that there's a lot more to it than that, but that would certainly help. And if you could, you know, and going back to slide six, include Texas, Alaska, North Dakota, Alberta. You mentioned Russia, just to make sure that we've got those in there. And that would certainly help, just whenever, I don't know, at the next meeting or whatnot.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Foster, we'll see what we can do. And the only reason I so quickly was able to say that Russia's new tax terms were lower than Alaska's, Pedro Van Meers happened to email us and say their tax terms are now lower than Alaska's. So that's based on his reading of it, not based on DORs after 2 days and almost no information other than news releases.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian, if you could, on the chart, and put a mark when, like when PTT went into effect and when ACEs went into effect, because it's not always when we passed it. So if you could put a mark on there, when, just a mark saying, so we know when they went into effect and how that affected.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Butcher, we've heard questions that are premised on the idea that there's factors other than the taxation rates are responsible for production in Alaska and elsewhere, and that's understandable. It's a pretty complicated system. You know, we can see what has happened, but what we're trying to get to is why it's happened. That's the most important for our debate here. How precisely can you or anybody else tease out what factors are affecting oil production? You know, we've got lots of co-occurring variables. How accurately can anyone suss out the effect of any one?
To the chair, Representative Sadler, it really is a difference, a company-by-company basis. As an example, you know, Repsol has had some issues with some of their leases being taken away in other countries. So I think to Repsol in the point of time, and this is just my opinion, but Repsol at the point in time in which they were interested in Alaska, there were different other factors they were looking at than maybe another company that, say, was entirely a North America-centric company. And so it really is a company-by-company kind of discussion on how they view the world. And they could probably enlighten you more, you know, at the point in which they're in front of the committee.
Yeah. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of clarifying questions and then one question after that. Commissioner, on slide 7, of course, 3001 wants to reduce the production tax. Did I understand you say that we should consider reducing the tax credits as well?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, at this point, we see the tax credit side of ACES as working. We see it doing what we had hoped it would do, which was bring new companies into the state, bring new potential investment into the state. The Department of Revenue is beginning to dig a little bit more into trying to separate out what the effects of all these things are. We're not going to know that probably for a few years, and even then it may be very limited. We're trying to determine as best we can the benefits and the detriments of them, but at this point, we see it as a generally positive piece of ACES.
Second clarifying question, Mr. Chairman. On slide 9, and of course you talked about the price of oil, I thought I heard you say that it's predicted that that the price of oil stay relatively stable, bouncing up a little bit around the red line, around $100?
Through the chair, Representative Harris, yes, it seems like the department, as well as most experts, see it around 1 to 110 generally.
And, Mr. Chairman, the question is the decline curve is at 6% now with private sector's investments of about $1 billion a year. So with 3001 legislation, would we reduce the decline curve to 3% at 1, at 2B, 3B, 4B?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, that is a difficult question to answer, and that's something that we have been trying to work with internally, and I think we're going to talk to DNR about trying to determine in a ballpark what would have to be needed on a year-to-year basis and what that might. I don't know that we can ever come to a chart that can do something like that because of the variables of, if you're a new company looking to explore, the number of billions you're going to have to pay is going to be much larger than if you're an existing producing company trying to get more oil out of the field that might be economic to develop down to a certain percentage, but not below that. But we're working on trying to see if we can come up with something that might give a ballpark on that.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up to that answer, is so the governor wishes to get back up to a million, and we're at 500,000. So these incremental investments, whether it's 2B, 3B, or 4B, that would just flatten it out. So 3001 over time would get us back up to a million?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, a million barrels a day is a goal that it would be great to attain, and I think DNR would probably say exactly what we're going to say, which is to one day hit a million barrels a day is going to require probably a number of things, shale, potentially heavy, and other things. If we, over the next 5 years, can flatten it out and begin to turn it around like Texas has done, personally, I would be thrilled to death.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And the effect of that financially for the state, if we were to flatten out the curve, and at least not decline as steeply as we are, would be what?
Mr. Chairman, it would help certainly solidify and make for a rosier fiscal future for the state than we have currently. The high price of oil, which is much higher than it's ever historically been, has kind of done a pretty good job of hiding the fact that we're declining. You know, as long as the state brings in more money than it puts out, I think Alaskans are happy. They're not thinking a lot of the issues that they thought about not too many years ago when there were policy discussions about paying state income taxes, state sales taxes, permanent fund dividend checks going away, deep cuts in the budget, a lot of those things. However, as we continue to decline, we move into deficit, and if the price of oil should drop, and I think we're in the mid-90s right now on what we need to balance our budget, we drop much below that. We have $90 a barrel oil next year, and we're in a deficit.
Okay. Representative Seaton, and then I've got Rep. Pruitt, and then we're going to go on to the next presenter. Did you hear what I just said?
I have a question.
I have a question also.
I understand. We also have another presenter. You have a limited amount of time. Representative Seaton.
We're talking billions of dollars, and it's appropriate for us to ask our questions on the record in committee, and this is the time to do it.
We'll get to that. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. A couple of questions on capital. On your slide 7, you were saying that the tax credits were there, but they weren't working to get the small players to invest in to bring capital in from large players because of the tax rate. So are you then saying that the small players in Cook Inlet are having no problems getting large amounts of capital invested in their operations when they have discoveries because of the zero tax rate in Cook Inlet?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the Cook Inlet, you're correct, the taxes are much lower than they are in the North Slope. However, the potential for oil finds in the Cook Inlet is estimated to be much, much smaller than the North Slope. So I think we're looking at a different animal. But DNR could probably enlighten you a little bit more about the difference of potential finds in the two regions than I could.
Okay, well, I just want to make sure that when we establish that, oh, tax rates are what's driving small producers not to have access to capital, that, you know, we're saying, well, we'll say that here, but we're not saying it in the other places, and there's several factors. But I guess, you know, testimony that the committee has had over time on getting capital here, one of them was that small producer tax credit isn't being effective at getting that capital. I presume that that is the function of SB 3001, the new oil portion, is to bring capital in. And we had testimony of the committee that the small producer tax credit expiring in 2016 does not allow them to bring capital in, because by the time they get production going, the tax credit would be gone. Does the administration support extending that to, say, 2022, so that the small producers would be able to get capital invested, because they know that that tax credit would be available once they get into production?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, that's something we'd be happy to work with the committee on.
And another thing is on the facility access and getting that capital in there. I mean, capital underground is one thing. Capital above ground is another. We had a proposal by one of the small producers that has oil, has found oil, has tested flow, basically. And they came to the state asking for a loan for production facilities for, you know, to get over this access bottleneck. Is the administration supportive of providing incentive for capital for production facilities to ease the access problem, as well as just well capital?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's an issue I don't know enough about. You might ask Mr. Barron. He may have more information on that than I do.
Okay, and just to follow up on that, I would like to, because it's, I mean, if this is the crux of the new oil portion to bring capital to Alaska and to get it there, and if facility access has been identified in numerous publications and by numerous individual companies, I'd like the Department of Revenue to look at that and see if we can make a loan at 10% interest, whether that's something that we should do, if we could facilitate getting oil in the pipeline by 2014, you know, 2 years sooner than the Point Thompson 10,000 barrels a day. So anyway, as we continue along with the new tax portion of this, I'd appreciate that. Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, absolutely, we'd be happy to. The governor is focused on getting more production in the pipeline, and by no means is this governor's bill or any governor's bill the only way we can do that. We're certainly open to discussing anything that can achieve those goals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, on slide two, no one will argue with your first bullet point that oil prices have been at all-time highs for several years. One of the questions I think is important is a couple of the different regimes that are out there, it seems to be that they've peaked right at the perfect time, right when prices are high. And we refer to them quite a bit as the success that they're having. How confident is the Department of Revenue that if we make these changes, that we're not going to be Johnny Come Lately, that things are going to change, that the prices will go down, and we'll find ourselves short in the future because we're trying to react to the success that other individuals and other regimes are having?
Through the chair, Representative, there's never going to be a definitive answer to that question. There are estimates on what the price of oil is going to do. There's estimates on what's going to happen with the world economy in the future. But the general sense is the U.S. economy, the world economy, is going to be expanding at some point in the future. That's only going to make the need for oil even more than it is today. So there's certainly no way of being able to tell definitively in the future, but it appears that looking out that this is going to be a world that's going to need oil more than it's going to not need oil.
I'll offer it.
And to follow up on that, what impact do you see some of the new regimes that are coming online? Of course, you know, the Falklands is a new one. We're talking, you know, visited Iceland. They've got potentials out there. Different dynamics. It's you know, there's still a lot to go on. They're not necessarily saying that they're going to be some new bevy of a bunch of oil coming out of the ground. But there's a lot of places that have these prospects. How do you foresee that the impact of these new regimes bringing new oil into the market could potentially impact this? And again, are the value of oil that we'll be seeing in the benefit to Alaskans?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think the biggest advantage Alaska has is that we're stable politically, and I think companies see that, and that's a benefit. I mean, we have difficulties here, but that's a huge benefit, and I think that it's a goal not just of the state of Alaska, but of Congress and of the president to become more energy dependent, and that's where Alaska can really help in this equation, because to be less reliant on volatile areas of the world is always going to make sense, I think.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Representative Kawasaki, then Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 8, just before the wrap-up, you were talking about sort of the comparisons under ELF, PPT, and ACES, and sort of showing a comparison. And one of the statements you had made is that under the ELF system, we weren't really getting our fair share. Is that paraphrase? Is that pretty much what you said?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes. I don't believe that at the levels ELF, where ELF eventually got, that the state of Alaska was receiving what they should have been in terms of oil tax.
And it's because, you know, under ELF, the companies and the corporations, specifically in the two big legacy fields, were taking that money, or taking the money. Now, if you go two slides prior to that, three slides to the decline curve that we see so often here, you know, under that decline curve, we were under ELF. I mean, under the precipitous decline between 1988 and 1990, when the limit factor triggered to 2003, we kept going down. I mean, right? I guess, you know, the whole assumption is that if taxes are lower, that we'll somehow get more production. But we've seen over our entire history that even when taxes were very low, even when prices were very high, and I've got other graphs I'll submit to testimony, we really haven't seen an increment in the two big legacy fields. And I'm wondering how you or how the administration, how Department of Revenue intends to change that. I mean, how will this bill change that when for so long we've seen a decline under ELF when we were getting very little taxes and the companies were getting a higher percentage of profit?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, when you look at what the price of oil was during those times, they were, even when they got to what would be a representatively high level of a barrel of oil, $40, $45, it still wasn't near what we're looking at today. And I think when you combine technological advancements with what we're looking at, certainly, and I would be surprised if companies base their, in fact, I've had companies tell us that they base their decisions not on 100 to 120. We make our best estimates on what the forecast is, but they're going to be more conservative on where they look. But it's a different view of the world they're looking at today than they were looking at that time.
I guess, I mean, you didn't really answer the question. The question was, when taxes were exceedingly low under Prudhoe-Banks Park, we saw decline curves that were even greater than they are currently. And the entire assumption is if we somehow change the tax, change taxes, give oil companies more money, that they will, in fact, reinvest them into declining legacy fields. And I guess, you know, we haven't seen that before, so why do we expect to have a different outcome now?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, companies can certainly give you a little insight into this, but if you've got a model that you're running that includes taxes and includes your operating costs, capital costs, at what you estimate to be $20 a barrel oil, and then you run another economic model at what you believe to be $80 a barrel oil, the economics and fields and things that become economic at $80 weren't economic at $20. As a good example, oil for a period of time was $9, $10. We could have zero taxes, and there's nothing on the North Slope that's going to be economic with $10 oil.
Is that Pruitt?
I wanted to follow up on that. What impact, of course, 89 is the fall of the wall. What impact did 89 have on the opening of significant amount of different oil basins that were not available prior, where people could invest their money, and now there was an opportunity to spread the money that was the capital to many different locations that weren't available before? What impact did that have on Alaska going from being the center of the world, the everything? There was a huge focus on us to now looking at many different regimes, many different areas, and the decrease coming about from that.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that is a good question. And I know that in Pedro Van Meers's presentation, he laid out what we were looking at 20 years ago in terms of the number of countries that would be stable and friendly to outside companies, meaning American companies, and what we'd be looking at today. And it was radically different, the number of companies or the number of countries that are available for investment by multinationals today compared to then. And it did. It definitely changed the landscape of where companies were looking.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Back when we were on page... the page number. Oh, right, the second to the last page with a price per barrel. We were talking about what would be needed to reduce the decline curve in investment and about the governor's goal of getting it up to a million barrels a day, production up to a million barrels a day. And you indicated that to do that would require many different kinds of oil, shale, heavy oil, as well as legacy fields. And I would like to see what the administration believes would be sort of the, if House Bill 3001 passed, what would be the various proportions that would go into this $1 million a barrel goal, where the sources would be. And then secondary to that, Exxon had testified some time ago that it would take $3 to $5 billion a year to stem the decline in legacy fields. And I'm actually not sure if they said stem the decline or reverse the decline, which are two different things. But in either way, do you think that passage of this bill would result in that kind of investment, and what kind of data would you have to support that?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, for your first question, we'll talk to DNR about that to see if there's a ballpark way. What makes it so difficult is heavy oil, shale oil. It could come on in 5 years. It could come on in 10 years. It may never be economic. We just don't know enough about it at this point to be able to figure that out. Maybe there's something we could put together in terms of potential or something. We'll talk to DNR. We'll see if we can do that.
It seems to me we're talking about this kind of money, this kind of state participation, and also rolling things back, that we should have some estimates of where it's going to come from, which kind of fields, because the tax structure can be designed to support heavy oil or specifically legacy fields or shale, where we can be targeted. And indeed, some of our consultants have suggested that's what we need to do. But we can't do that effectively and efficiently if we don't know what our target is.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's something that we talk with companies about. That's something that we, you know, certainly if there's a lever that can be moved, that can make something happen that currently wouldn't be occurring now, those are conversations the legislature will be having, the governor will be having. What we do know is making the investment climate more economic and taxes lower are going to make the economics of everything better. Some things it's going to be enough, and it'll be a company-by-company discussion that you'll have to have. A lot of the legacy fields, there's going to be things economic that aren't today. Where that's going to take us with other things or other questions. But the one thing we know for sure is everything becomes somewhat more economic if we make the change.
And follow-up, a company-by-company discussion that we have to have. And, well, I believe that's true, but nevertheless, this is the administration's proposal, so I would expect you to have that kind of information and indeed be having those discussions as you make this proposal for us. And related to that, yesterday morning the Senate asked a host of questions, and I didn't – I was interested in those answers because I think they would that data would be of interest and of value in considering the presentations that we anticipate having this week. So and some of those things you were going to try to get yesterday, and I understand you were with us yesterday afternoon. Do you have a timeline as to when we might get the
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we hope to get that to the Senate and to this committee sometime early next week. We were unable to do it in that time frame for the exact reason you gave. When I said when they asked if I could get it by the end of day, and I said we would try to, I wasn't thinking that we were all going to be tied up in another committee for the rest of the day. So,
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. With that, we'll take a brief at ease while the next presenter gets set up. Two-minute at ease. Resources Committee, back to order. Mr. Behrens, floor is yours.
Good morning. I'm Bill Behrens, and I'm the Director of Oil and Gas for the State of Alaska. And joining me this morning is Commissioner Norman, John Norman with the AOGCC. What we've got this morning is the Commissioner has a few prepared statements, and he'll run through that, and either while he's doing that as a tag team or following that, I've got a short presentation that I think addresses some of the questions that were brought up during the revenues presentation. So with that, I'll give it to the Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name for the record is John Norman. I'm the Public Commissioner for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. My colleague, Kathy Forrester, is traveling, and she sends her regrets, so I'm here filling in for her. And today I will characterize some of the potential sources of increased oil and gas production for the state of Alaska. I'll briefly discuss legacy fields, new discoveries, heavy oil, shale oil, condensate from Point Thompson, outer continental shelf oil, ANWR, production from the Beaufort Sea, and North Slope gas. As to each of these resources, I'll briefly describe the potential for increasing production and some of the challenges that attach to that increase. Our legacy fields are Alaska's bird in the hand, and I think this is where I really want to start out, and if Kathy were here, I think this is what she always likes to emphasize. We count on these fields day in and day out, and we have to be careful not to ignore the importance of our legacy fields or take them for granted. During the regular session, Commissioner Forrester testified that the health of all of the fields on the North Slope depends to a degree on the health of Prudhoe Bay, and this is true, and it's going to remain true for the foreseeable future. In my mind, I often think of it as a real estate manager does, an anchor tenant in a shopping mall. If you've got a good anchor tenant there, a healthy anchor tenant, it helps everyone. If that anchor tenant begins to become enfeebled, then that spells trouble for the entire shopping mall. So our anchor tenant, in my mind, that's my characterization of it, but is the Prudhoe Bay field. You will likely remember that the original estimates years ago for the Prudhoe Bay field were 9 billion barrels of oil. To date, we've recovered more than 11 billion, and there are still about 2 billion barrels of oil remaining at that giant field, remaining to be recovered. With the possible exception of the Bakken field now that there's been discussion on in North Dakota, this remaining asset there is larger than any discovery in the United States, certainly in many, many years. One way I think of it is if you could magically take a giant eraser and just take the map of Alaska and wipe everything clean and then tell someone, go put an oil hole right wherever you like, and they drilled it right at Prudhoe Bay, with what's there today, they would have just discovered one of the, if not the largest, conventional oil fields in the United States. So that's what we have, you have, right now before us, and it's important as we talk about other things not to lose sight of that and take it for granted. The Prudhoe Bay owners are expending lots of technical effort and money to finesse the additional oil out of the ground. Negative impacts on profitability, and these would be things such as a drop in the price of oil, increases in taxation, increases in regulatory burden, will put some of these 2 billion barrels at risk. Conversely, there is increased potential for greater ultimate recovery from Prudhoe Bay, depending upon advances in technology and things that might positively, in the future, impact profitability. We don't have control over technology or advances or oil price, but we can certainly caution in increasing the burden on an operator, either through taxation or regulation. This is a given. I've talked about Prudhoe Bay, but this characterization is valid for Alaska's other legacy fields as well. I'll shift now to new discoveries. New discoveries are already positively impacting the production profile of Alaska, and we must continue to encourage new operators to take the risks to explore for new reservoirs. Right now, it's not likely that we're going to find another Prudhoe Bay in the areas where exploration is currently allowed. Easy to find fields in at least the Upper Cook Inlet region, as well as the Central North Slope, have been found. That said, there is nothing wrong with an Alpine field, a North Star, a Kayachek, or other smaller fields. And I use the term small advisedly, because elsewhere these would be considered huge fields. It frankly is our cost and our remote location that works against us somewhat and forces us to call these smaller fields when, if they were found in a lower cost, more hospitable location, I think they would be, relatively speaking, considered larger. The what makes these fields viable is their proximity to the infrastructure that exists now in the legacy fields. So another factor to keep in mind is as exploration moves further from proximity to these legacy fields and from our anchor tenant, if you will, the Prudhoe Bay field, the challenges of commercializing these fields increase. Heavy and viscous oil is the subject of attention right now by industry, and I know you're all aware of it. The resource estimates for heavy and viscous oil vary depending on who you talk to, but just about everyone agrees that there are at least 20 billion barrels of potential as to this resource on the North Slope. It's not an easy resource to commercialize. You can, again, conjure up various pictures in your mind, but one I've heard said is that if you took a sandbox and filled it full of molasses and then gave somebody a drinking straw and said, recover the molasses, that's the challenge that you're looking at. The key to developing this will be advances in technology, and we know at the AOGCC that research is ongoing actively, not just here in Alaska also. There are other jurisdictions and international companies that are looking at this. So it's something to look forward to, but it's certainly not a bird in the hand. Shale oil development has created a boom in the lower 48, and this is extending now from New York, Pennsylvania, on through to North Dakota. Shale is often the normal source for oil that then migrates into the conventional reservoirs that we're aware of. In some ways, as to shale here, the geological risk is low because we know and can predict where the source rock is. The risk lies instead in whether there's enough oil and whether it can be removed and extracted from rock. The only real way to find out is to drill and begin to produce it. We do have exploration incentives in place. These have already piqued the interest of at least one shale oil explorer, Great Bear, and this will be the subject I think that Bill will comment on further. I'll move on to gas liquids. Different agencies have different estimates as to the amount of condensate associated with gas at the Point Thompson field. I think it's safe to say that we have at least 200 to 400 million barrels of oil at that field in Point Thompson. It was very good news to get the word of the settlement of the Point Thompson litigation. That was worrying to the commission because there is a significant conservation issue. Anytime you have liquid associated with gas, there's always a trade-off. You may want to try to move to blow down the field, but at the same time, every time you do, invariably, you're going to lose some liquids. It's just a matter of how much. So the idea is to try to optimize and develop the field first. In an ideal world, you would try to produce every single drop of liquid and then blow down the field, but that's often not possible. Point Thompson, right now, the operator has presented and is working on a cycling project to recover the liquids, and these will be put into taps. This is another example of a known resource with an uncertain outcome. We know the condensate is there. We just don't know if cycling to recover it is going to be commercially viable. The outcome of this pilot project will provide us valuable answers. I'll talk now quickly about the Outer Continental Shelf. As you know, Alaska's jurisdiction runs seaward for 3 miles, and then we also, by law, have the ability for some revenue sharing from 3 miles out to 6 miles additionally. Our legacy fields are Alaska's bird in the hand, but the OCS is a bird in the bush. There is significant potential for the Outer Continental Shelf off Alaska to offer opportunity for a large oil discovery. One indication of this is Shell wouldn't be so patient in attempting to explore there if they didn't believe this was the case. A discovery, even though it's in federal waters, will have enormous benefits for Alaska, everything from jobs to extending the life of taps. Other than geologic risk, the greatest obstacles to development of the OCS off of Alaska are the policies of our own federal government. So one thing Alaskans should continue to do is try to exert influence in every way possible to temper these policies. We're often asked at the Commission about the recent events in the Gulf of Mexico, and if time permitted, I could offer some contrasts, but our situation here is significantly different. At the Commission, that's our job, is to watch out for this. Our jurisdiction is, you know, runs statewide. We exercise the police power of the state. We're not a property management agency. And our opinion is that resource development can occur responsibly and carefully. We all live here, and we want to be sure that that's the way it does proceed. No discussion would be complete without at least some mention of ANWR. We don't know now, and we won't know until there is actual drilling again and an assessment what the potential of ANWR is. But our belief is that it can be done responsibly and that it's not an either-or situation. The area needed, is, as we all know, is relatively small. The obstacle right now is political. That's a giant obstacle, but we have seen in the history, in the proud history of our country, many times where there were political obstacles, and then when the conditions change, why, suddenly the nation realizes that there is a need for the resource. Right now, we're being denied the opportunity to even assess and quantify this resource, and that strikes us at the Commission as somewhat irresponsible. The Beaufort Sea, right now we have oil already being produced offshore in the Beaufort Sea. North Star, Endicott, part of Agouric, they're all in the Beaufort Sea. There are other likely oil deposits yet to be discovered there, and at least one exploration effort is in the planning at Liberty. Liberty will be in federal waters, but success there will still, for the reasons I indicated before, reap benefits for Alaska. Liberty will not be without risks because it is what's called an ultra-extended reach well. It will begin from Endicott Island and travel out underground for several miles. The sort of drilling required for Liberty will push the limits of current drilling technology. Because of this and other reasons, the operator has kept the Commission very closely advised. We're also coordinating with federal oversight agencies, and we are satisfied that the operator is proceeding diligently and cautiously to ensure that all technical risks and challenges are assessed and addressed before work begins. Last, I'll just briefly address North Slope Gas. I say briefly because for years you all have been saturated, I think, with a lot of information on North Slope Gas. The only thing I think I could offer from the perspective of the Commission is to reinforce the notion that right now we have the bird in the bush of these, bird in the hand of these legacy fields. And so what we want to do is be careful that we use this gas, which represents reservoir energy, properly. It is still the opinion of the Commission that every bit of known North Slope gas associated with an oil reservoir either is or will be beneficially used to get more oil out of the ground. There is a way to orchestrate this and time it so that when the time comes and if conditions are right for a major gas sale, then there are procedures for adjusting and setting a new offtake rate, and then the gas can begin to be removed. But for right now, we're satisfied that industry is proceeding properly and that the gas is being cycled in a beneficial manner. Another point to be made is the observation that until 2005, 2006, oil and gas, those two commodities, were pretty much in tandem, somewhat related. And then since that time, they have cut loose and decoupled, and they now proceed and are valued independently. Oil, of course, we've had a lot of presentation on the value of oil. Gas, for the benefit of the nation right now, we're somewhat awash in gas, and consequently the relative values are no longer the same. So I think, again, it's something that as legislators, as property managers, as Alaskans, we need to keep an eye on and make sure that we underscore the importance of not selling gas if it means that we're going to sacrifice getting some oil out of the ground to do so. A final point that was on the list that I was asked to address was the subject of gas to liquids technology. This could be the subject of an hour or two presentation, and there are others that have far more expertise than I do, but I believe you know right now that this, at least currently, is a very inefficient way to develop a product. you lose about 40% of the resource in the process of going from gas to gas liquids. Also, gas liquids plants are very, very expensive. They are proceeding. I mentioned Shell before, and Shell right now is constructing some of the largest plants in the world. And so we are optimistic that in the future there may be some promise for gas liquids, but right now the jury's out. That concludes my remarks, and so I'll be happy either now or at the end of Mr. Barron's presentation to take your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Norman. Just a quick question on the, you mentioned the offtake rate on the slope, and I believe that's currently 2.7 BCF of gas. I understand that's not something you reevaluate on even an annual basis. When was the last time, when was that number arrived at originally, and how has it changed over the years?
The number was originally arrived at many years ago, I think probably 25 to 30 years ago, when the commission hired consultants and went in and assessed it. And it was determined that without harming the ability to produce oil at that time, that you could take off about 2 billion cubic feet per day, and then about 0.7 would be needed just for fuel and consumption as part of the process. That number remained in existence for a long time, and it does remain today as part of the commission rule setting the ground rules for producing the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir. A few years back, whenever there was the Stranded Gas Act and then there was a GIA and so forth, we became concerned because no one was coming to the commission saying, here's your application. That's the way the process is supposed to work. A company comes to the commission and says, we are hereby applying to you to amend and change the Prudhoe Bay offtake rate. They suggest a number to us, and they document that. We then have to go through a public process. It's published. There's opportunity for the public, others, certainly the legislature, to weigh in on that. And then as a result, an administrative record is made, and it's not something that we just arbitrarily do. It's a number that's carefully looked at. We went through the process because we did not want to be the cause of any delay in a major gas sale or a pipeline. And so we felt like by running alongside and trying to keep up, we could position ourselves so at least we could move quickly. We also entered into some cooperative agreements with the operators both at Prudhoe Bay, and we've done the same thing at Point Thompson, to gain as much information as we can so that the commission will not be the cause of any delay if we get to the point where there's a major gas sale. But as a result of our inquiry, we determined that we did not have enough information to adjust it upward. No one had come in and said, we want you to go to 4, 4.5, 5 BCF a day, and we concluded there was insufficient information in the record. We do recognize that at the point, whenever a company or a consortium of companies is ready to go forward with a project, then we're prepared to very quickly revisit that as part of a public process and then make an appropriate adjustment. I'll add a final footnote to that, that with each passing day, as oil's coming down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the conservation issue and the worry we have gets less and less and less because more the oil is coming out, and at some point it will be simply a matter of blowing down the field. That's not necessarily the case at Point Thompson. We've got, as I mentioned, 2 to 4 million barrels of liquid there, and that liquid is valuable. That's the size of an alpine field, and that's what's at risk were you simply to go straight into blowing down the Point Thompson field, simply because of the characteristics of that field.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. And your comments regarding ANWR, my question is, what knowledge do we have, even though we haven't drilled directly on ANWR,
what knowledge do we have that leads us to believe that it contains so much oil?
The commission is the repository of confidential information filed with the state, entrusted to the state of Alaska. We have certain information in our possession at the commission that has been entrusted to us, and that's been the subject of litigation, and that also is been afforded extended confidentiality. That's by law, that wherever there is unleased acreage around and one operator has made the significant proprietary investment to drill and get that information, they should be able to get the benefit of that before it becomes public to the world. So that's a way of telling you. We have perhaps one or two people at the commission that could begin to answer your question. Our access to information to the commission is on the need-to-know basis, just the same as the military. We purposely limited it. I don't want to know the answer to that because I don't, if it ever got out, I want to know how it got out. So in other words, that's proprietary information to the companies that have drilled wells inside and more. And there are, of course, estimates that can be made, and Mr. Barron can perhaps speak to that. The USGS has had some estimates, and there are a number of figures. So I think it's reasonable to think that that there is potential there. As far as giving you a specific answer, I don't want to get into that because it would intrude on our obligation to keep information confidential.
Understand. Questions from the committee? Representative Kalsoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Commissioner, for being here. And you started your discussion with Prudhoe Bay, and I think that all of us are excited to hear. I think as a state we've been blessed by having one of the largest fields, and with recoverable oil that's still in the ground, I think it's still double that of the next largest field, which is the East Texas oil field. So I think that's promising looking forward for the state. But a question dealing with Prudhoe and Kuparuk and the legacy fields is, are there any other examples of fields that size or conventional oil fields of that size that have changed the typical characteristic, being ramping up and then dropping down precipitously. And part of the discussion here has been, is there a way to change that production curve and production decline, but specifically in a mature field that's that old? Do you have examples of that? Or?
Yes. Representative Kalsak, through the chair. At the commission right now, we don't know of any way to interrupt what you would expect normally with a field like that. There are always a lot of innovations going on. It was just a few weeks ago that some people came into the – I mean, we're always having people stop by, and we welcome them to tell us what's going on. But, for example, there are people experimenting with injecting microbial agents into the ground, the bacteria that would, again, break up the oil. So when Prudhoe Bay started, that original DeGolyer MacNaughton study was in the range of 9 billion barrels, and already we have gotten more. There are other things that have occurred. Some years back, the operator came in and proposed to the commission that they'd be allowed to inject water into the gas cap. That seems counterintuitive to me, that how can you improve a reservoir by pushing? But our belief is that that's been beneficial. We think that the value being there, and if the price holds and the conditions are right, why, something will happen, but I don't know of anything right now that would interrupt what we see as just the normal decline in the life of the field. Mr. Barron, though, I think has, I've got to acknowledge his expertise is greater than mine.
And you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned gas to pressurize, repressurize. Mr. Chairman. On repressurizing fields, because I just learned that as a coming into the legislature several years ago, that how much volumes of gas are used and why that's so necessary. As the legislature sort of discussing how we monetize natural gas, how we get it to a place like the center Fairbanks, where we've said we need natural gas. How, if it's the theory that we're that the AFGCC is trying to produce more oil and not jeopardize oil production for gas production, where's the nexus in that, and how we get natural gas monetized for some place like Fairbanks or for the state, for in-state use?
Sure, sure. We have written a letter, and I will provide it upon request, but the AOGCC would not see any problem with drawing down up to 2.7 BCF a day. That would be more than adequate to handle the in-state need, certainly. So I don't want to say that taking off any gas is problematic. It's not. But it is were we to launch into major gas sales in the range of 4 or 5 or greater BCF, then that's where it requires some very careful analysis, and it's a balancing act to make sure that in the doing of that, you don't leave oil behind. But the interesting thing is you're talking now about events. This is like asking a real estate appraiser to tell you, please come and appraise my house, but I want you to tell me what it'll be worth in 2018, 2021. So in some ways, our intuitive feeling is we can get there. We will get there with Prudhoe Bay. Point Thompson is more problematic, but with Prudhoe Bay, and certainly with gas for in-state use, if that's the way the legislature goes, I do not see any difficulty there in taking off that amount of gas.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony. I like your analogy that Prudhoe Bay is like the anchor tenant in a shopping mall, and I kind of would maybe consider adding something along the lines. And in our circumstances, it's as if the anchor tenant also controlled the elevators and the doors. And, you know, they could negotiate that with newcomers or not as they chose. You testified about the remaining oil and the barrels that could be at risk with low prices or with a tax burden, was what you said. And over the years, we've had a lot of testimony from various legislative consultants and experts about decision-making and the impact of taxes. And, you know, my takeaway is that prospectivity and price are the two biggest determinants far and away. And then beyond that, there's a whole stable of considerations, including the tax burden, but that doesn't stand separate from the credits and the incentives and, you know, other sorts of terms. So I'm just sort of curious. I know that the AOGCC, most of the commissioners, their qualifications are in statute, and people bring different kinds of backgrounds. Is there anybody on the AOGCC who is an expert in tax structure, petroleum economics, or anything along those lines?
No, that's not. We exist to try to provide factual information to the Department of Revenue, to others. As I said, our jurisdiction is statewide, so it doesn't just go into the state's 100 million acres, but where there are oil to be produced from federal lands, our jurisdiction runs there over into the NPRA on the state, on the native corporations, 44 million acres, et cetera. So on the issue of tax, no. I would say it's been very interesting to me to sit here and listen, and I began my career, now it's almost 50 years ago in Texas, and then came up here before Prudhoe Bay, and I worked in the state at the time. I mean, remember when we had our big lease sale? I've gone back and read the history. I know why we're a state. It's simply because of oil at Swanson River. I know the hopes, the expectations. I did bring here a copy because I know many of you have this, but it's the history of how Prudhoe Bay was selected by the state of Alaska and how we almost missed it. These are some of the basins throughout the state. Again, we're talking right now about the North Slope, but there are many basins right now. We've had wells drilled in the Yukon Candy, the Copper River. There's the North Aleutian Basin. And in my early days up here, Our focus was along the Gulf of Alaska, the Robinson Mountains areas. There were wells drilled out. There was a well drilled out on Middleton Island. We have a big, big state here, and insofar as taxation is concerned, I think one thing you can say with a certainty is that you're not going to get, you're not going to increase production by taxing it higher. Now, that's a simplistic statement, but it's just not going to occur. So if you want, it's all part of a total climate in my years of working in the industry. The industry, the main thing I think they want is access. They want to be able to get in and have access, and then they will look around what infrastructure exists, and then the industry also, there's a herd mentality to it. They're what are called oil plays and hot areas, and companies don't want to be left out of a certain area. If the Falkland Islands is hot or off the coast of Brazil or wherever, they'll move in that direction. So I have a belief that Alaska's time will come around again, but right now we don't have that cachet that we had at one time. I say that because I interact with a whole lot of regulators and officials in other states, and I know the mindset there. I know in Texas there is a far greater understanding of the industry that exists here in Alaska. And I speak as a 50-year Alaskan. My kids were born here, went to university, and this is where I will remain. But in Texas, there is also less hostility. And we have to be honest. For some reason, I think if you don't understand something, you're suspicious of it, and you're a little bit standoffish. So I think sometimes we're unnecessarily hostile to an industry that has provided and is providing tremendous benefits. That's not to say that it does not need to be carefully regulated, obey our laws, hire our citizens, but I don't see the need sometimes that exists for the hostility that exists. On the notion of taxation, I'll just throw this out again, Representative Gardner, because you gave me an opportunity, but I hear a statement here in Alaska that I don't often hear in other states. And that is, let's get our fair share. Let's do this. How do we know when we got our fair share? The fair share is a concept that comes with what Bill Barron does. Whenever you hold oil and gas lease sales, and there are variables, you get the royalty, you get as much bonus money as you can up front, you promote that sale, you try to attract as many people as you can, and then you make the best possible deals you can, and try to encourage the development through a lot of tools you have, unit agreements and exploration licenses, and you try to promote as much as you can the production. I've always viewed tax as a whole different creature. Tax is something that I think it's dangerous if a government says, yeah, we're going to come around and take another bite of the apple through the taxing power, because I think of what if I was operating a car wash and suddenly the state of Alaska comes up and says, we hear, Norman, you're doing pretty good, so we want our fair share. The tax policy, I've always thought, starts from a whole different premise, is what do we need to fund government and take care of the needs of our citizens, and that's the starting place there, not how much can we get right up to the point where we press somebody. It's a vantage point, but the reason I mention it is I have had many good conversations with Governor John Hoeven of North Dakota. And at one time I thought he was, I thought he didn't have a good perception of reality, because he was talking to me about getting the people of North Dakota trained and ready for jobs, and this was in 2004. And I looked at the production in North Dakota, and I was thinking, jobs for what? But that man was farsighted, and that business climate there is very positive. He's since gone on to the Senate, but I do know his mindset. He was a great leader. He was not hostile to the industry, but he also wanted a climate where industry came in, and they knew they were expected to obey the law, hire people from North Dakota, et cetera. Same thing in Texas. Some of that has to do with what you've touched on here, is that we do not have the broad base of private property ownership. So there's not a broad constituency of us Alaskans that necessarily understand the industry. And Alaskans get a permanent fund dividend check, but that connection is so indirect that by the time it lands in somebody's bank account, they can't quite make the connection between what you all are doing and the check that gets there. In other states, as was testified to, the mailman brings a royalty check. Mail person brings a royalty check, or a royalty check is deposited. And people take a very active interest in the industry. And if I could say anything, I would encourage us to be a little less hostile to the industry, watch them carefully, expect them to obey our laws, but not necessarily be quite as hostile as we all have been. And I think our hostility comes out of perhaps not understanding the business as well as they do in some other states.
Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, and I think your point is well taken in many regards. Your responsibility is to regulate the industry, and I suspect you would say that you have the information that you need in order to do that, much of which you can't share with us because of confidentiality. And our problem is that we don't always have the information to know the full impact of the decisions we make, and at the same time we've been admonished by the courts for being too trusting, and we don't have the information to verify to know what we need. And as to your analogy about the car wash and the government coming and taking more, I'm sometimes troubled by the fact that we call the severance tax a tax in the sense we're not, to me it's more of a sales price, that we have a limited resource. I mean, it's a huge resource that may or may not be developed in the way we would want, but our responsibility is to assure that we get the value of that for our children and our grandchildren, because one day that will be gone. And to let it flow away from us without us understanding the value and what is right is really unacceptable, and that's what makes these discussions so hard. I mean, the amounts of money that we talk about, it's really hard to even imagine that, and yet we have to vote, every one of us does. And it's very hard to be diligent and truly understand what we're doing when it's very difficult to get the information that we need. And I hope that you find it easier to get the information that you need. And part of it is the issue of confidentiality, which is very important. But I, for one, am reluctant to sign confidentiality agreements because I'm afraid that I'll forget where I learned something, and I want to be able to tell my constituents why I vote the way I do. I don't want it based on secrets and say, well, I know something you don't know, so I can't tell you about it, but just trust me. I don't want to be in that position. I have to be free to speak. So anyway, thank you very much.
Commissioner, I imagine it's hard to get an oil company to sign a confidentiality agreement if that's conditional upon their working on a project and developing a field. I'm kind of drowned out by the sirens there at one point, but I believe I heard you say that no one has ever increased production by increasing taxes.
As a general proposition, that was what I was volunteering, is that if... I mean, but that's a broad law of economics. if you want more of something, you don't increase the tax on it.
That's what I thought I heard you say. Representative Sutter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, again, the question I kind of asked, you probably already answered a little bit of this indirectly, but none of us is geologists, and there's lots of misinformation around there. Are there any false assumptions or common assumptions that are not correct that we should be aware of when it comes to the health of the North Slope oil and gas resources as we consider oil tax changes? Any common misconceptions we should avoid slipping into?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, none that come to mind. I'm assuming by health you mean ensuring greater ultimate recovery, the best possible recovery from our fields, and that, frankly, is our job. That's one of the reasons that a commission exists, is to watch that, to keep an eye over the fields. The first line of defense, of course, is the Division of Oil and Gas. They watch it carefully also, and we have a very good working relationship with them. But we're a backstop to that, And then if you get off of state lands onto native, the native's 44 million acres, for example, with wells drilled there, we watch that also. I know of no areas right now that should be brought to your attention. Things come up constantly that on a day-to-day basis, but that's part of our ongoing, we issue orders. Many of our, we fine millions of dollars if we find someone out of compliance with Alaska's regulations. And we issue conservation orders, and they're all on our website that you could read. But I don't know of anything from a tax standpoint that you should have in the front of your mind right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you know, obviously we're enjoying these extra days down in Juneau to talk about the oil basin. And so what I heard you say, well, it takes 8 BCF of gas to be produced and reinjected into the ground daily. But did you say that to maintain the maximum recovery of that oil basin, we could siphon off 2.7 BCF of gas for a future gas line? Is that correct?
For a future line, yes. And, of course, my question would be, what does future mean? How many? At what point in the future? Intuitively, we believe that if we're talking, the conversation generally has been 2017, 2018, 2019, and that is the opinion of the commission, yes, and if we get out there. Commissioner Forrest is always quick to say that if someone were to wave a magic wand and just suddenly say today they're going to start immediately pulling that off, we'd have to have an emergency meeting and look at it. But, yeah, that would work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was just going to ask you a little bit about shale oil, since this is something relatively recent, a development that they've, with new technology, been able to extract. And do we know what type of oil typically is produced from shale oil? Is this viscous oil, heavy oil, intermediate crude type oil, or is it just too soon to tell what type of oil we have here in Alaska that would be extracted from the shale deposits?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, I'll try and field that for the commissioner. The typical crude that is produced through the shale oil process is a very nice crude, typically in Eagleford and in the Bakken area. Quite frankly, we don't know what kind of crude will be extracted out of the Shublik and the Kinnack that we've got, because it hasn't been tested yet. Eagleford is a bit of a very unique structure. So to some degree, to Representative Sadler's question, there's a few pieces that, just in terms of technology and terminology, is I think some of the pitfalls that we as a state, and the commissioner tried to reference some of that everybody gets twisted up in a little bit of just misunderstanding some of the words and terminologies. The Eagleford, for example, has actually got three areas of development: a gas component, a condensate component, and an oil component. And the industry is chasing each one of those at its relative time relative to product price. So if there's a high gas demand and high gas price, the rigs will shift over and they'll do gas development in the Eagleford Shale gas zone. If they want to chase oil for product price, they move back and do the work in the oil zone. It's not too much different than Representative Kawasaki going into his office and deciding which of the ties he's going to pick off his rack on any given day. So it's how well he's going to look relative to the oil company that's looking at how well their bottom line is going to look, and that's how they're chasing it in Eagleford. So it's a difference.
I hope it's different.
Just a follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And looking at the map that you showed of the different areas around the state of Alaska that aren't on the North Slope, what type of laws or tax regimes could we create that might help those other areas get developed at a sooner time. And obviously, there are areas in the state that would like to be able to use, say, for example, natural gas locally that currently don't have any. And so if they were able to get that gas and use it locally, it would lower the cost of living significantly. But is there something that we can do as a legislature that would make developing those areas more viable more quickly?
I don't know of anything right now. What the best thing to get one of those areas to develop is to get someone to drill there and make a discovery, and then suddenly you're going to have a huge amount of attention on that area. In the meantime, to try to make something occur, it's very difficult to make something occur if the industry isn't really interested in that area. Now, I would add a footnote. We are seeing, anecdotally, through people passing through the commission, we're seeing some positive response to the incentives in Cook Inlet for drilling, taxation. We ask people, what brought you here? What are you doing? So there is a response. But in my experience, the best thing to do is to allow access and stability, predictability to industry, and then hope that there is a discovery. And if you make a discovery, then you're going to have people knocking at your door.
One real quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But the areas on that map that you showed, the geological formations have already been identified as having the potential to produce oil, gas, or condensates. Is that correct?
Representative Pearson, through the chair. Well, that's right. They're simply the geologic basins or areas that have potential, but the key word there is potential. By no means is it assured that you can get production from them.
Thank you. Representative Minder?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've understood that companies are thinking of investing up to $14 billion with more favorable fiscal terms in Alaska in legacy and new fields. And I'm wondering if you're able to estimate what $14 billion in investment might result in recoverable barrels. I mean, is there a way to take that level of investment and estimate what the range of possible benefit to the state would be?
Representative Munoz, Mr. Chair, I'm not able to do that. That would be just speculation on my part. A certain amount of the investment is simply maintaining where you are, and we have to recognize right now that we have aging infrastructure across the North Slope. That's been the cause of some of the problems, and it's like a house where the plumbing is getting older, and so you have to replace certain things, but it doesn't necessarily improve the flow of water. And I think your question was, well, how much of that is ordinary maintenance and how much of that could we see some incremental increase? And I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either to Mr. Barron or Mr. Norman, I'm not quite sure. I know this is a complicated decision-making matrix, but I have to ask this question. Can you give me any kind of relative ranking of the effects on oil production of some of the elements we discussed here? The state of the resource, commodity price, the technology, the taxes, the access. Can you roughly rank those?
through the chair, Representative Sadler, let me kind of capture the idea that you're trying to express is the industry is dealing with a multi-variable component in their decision-making process. There's product price, there's lifting costs, there's their own corporate overhead, there's facility costs. All of these variables come into play, the taxation, the fiscal regime, the environmental regime, the stability of the country, right? A lot of things come into play, access to resources. Each one of those, at any point in time, can shift the balance of any of these projects. A product price swing dramatically does make a difference. A new taxation or a reduction of tax does make a difference. But how do you balance those and try to give away to that it's very difficult to do. Most companies will run numerous hundreds of economic simulations to value and estimate to try and solve that very problem. And they will come up with, and each company is different, their assessment will be different. In some cases, taxation is on par with whether or not the regime is stable. So taxes versus do you think your assets are going to be nationalized? Those are some of the discussions that go on in the corporate offices. Product price. Do you assume that the product price is going to be stable for 5 years, or do you think it's going to be stable at a certain rate for 10 years? Every company has their own escalation factors, their own forecasting branch that takes a look at what they think product price is going to be. And most companies will run economics in a static position. They'll run it assuming a very low product price, and then they'll see which variable then drives it. Is it initial production or facility cost? So they'll run all of those, and it's a very, very dynamic multivariable model to run. So I can't answer the question specifically.
Brief follow-up with actually comments. So our mission and our challenge is to try and reverse engineer those and try and figure out what impact our taxes are going to be on different producers and different price points, different technology, different access, all those factors too.
Through the chair, Representative Federal, part of, I really don't want to step into your seats because you've got an incredibly difficult task in front of you. But I would sort of echo the commissioner's comments in it. What I think needs to happen is we need to understand and try and corral the things that we can control and the things that we can't control, and the things that we can influence. The question that Representative Peterson asked is also a good one, and it's what is impacting the ability to get to the new basins? And that's why I jumped into my first slide, because it plays into some of that question. And we have our own set of unique problems that are, some of which are, quite frankly, self-imposed. We have created some of these barriers to the industry. Some of it is for our own benefit. Some of it is for protection of other assets and other issues, granted, but they are barriers for another industry, and we need to recognize that. Winter exploration season. While that is really good and smart for true exploration, there are areas, Cook Inlet, for example, where winter exploration off of ice roads fundamentally just doesn't make a lot of sense. You can't maintain an ice road or an ice pad in the Cook Inlet region with any assuredness of being able to move your rig in and out at the end of the drilling season. So it's those kind of things that we need to think through and be very cognizant of the fact that becomes a barrier. Cost of development. There are things that are barriers to industry is just the cost of production. The Department of Revenue Commissioner commented on some of these, and I think he was really trying to capture, to Representative Seaton's question and point, the threshold, the hurdle rate. The way I took his response to your question was not necessarily economic hurdle rate, but the hurdles that have to be jumped by companies to get into the business. Some of these are the hurdles, the cost of production, the lack of physical infrastructure, roads. I mean, I know there's been a great deal of dialogue about roads to resources in this session. That's critical. And it's just not necessarily the North Slope. But let's pick on one, Badami. There is no road to Badami. They have to build an ice road every year. The state pays part of that. And every year it melts and goes away. Right, there are exploration areas that could be less challenging if there had always been a road to Badami. Let's bring it back off the slope and ask the question: other areas? I would point to the west side of the Cook Inlet. West side of Cook Inlet has no road. Again, challenging area for exploration and development. Potential gas-prone area of a world-class nature. Power distribution systems; those are limited. That increases the overall cost. Facilities and capacities. There's been a lot of discussion and dialogue about access to facilities.
that is a, and I've chatted with some of you individually about this, that is a very complicated economic and development process that, that has got to be worked integrally between two companies. The company who has the asset is also being challenged by many in the legislature to do more every day with what they've got. So if they tried to negotiate an agreement with somebody to enter into their facilities, if they had excess capacity, then that may limit their ability to do work on their current assets that they need to do, not only to satisfy the commission, but also to satisfy their obligations in their plan of development. Then the question comes in is back out. If that facility goes down, now you've got who's responsible or who's at risk for the loss of reserves and production through that may no fault of their own. It may just be equipment failure, or it may be, you know, just a, down, a routine downtime for maintenance. So these are very complicated negotiations, and every company is going to be a little different. Some companies absolutely do not want to be part of a shared facility. They want to be able to control their own destiny. They don't want to be saddled up with somebody. They want to have access to the pipelines. Sure, fair enough. And they do, right? Brooks Range is struggling right now on how to get some money to build their facilities. You know, shared facility may or may not work. They come out publicly saying that they tried to bring closure to that and really couldn't. So now it's going to be a standalone facility, 15,000 barrels a day. You know, I wish them luck. They've got to get the finances. But that's another resource the state can have to fill up part of the TAPS pipeline. Environmental subsistence issues and permitting. Some of these are very unique to Alaska. Some of that just is just a piece that we've got to struggle with that other areas don't. The environmental impact in North Dakota is really not there. Most of that is farming and ranching land. The natural vegetation was changed 100 years ago. Most of this is private land in North Dakota and Texas, privately owned surface and subsurface. You know, the permitting issues are tremendously low. Fear of litigation ties right back to the point I just made up about environmental issues. There's ongoing litigation risks, is that shell. And again, the last one that I'll just tap on, because it's been the subject of most of the discussion, is fiscal certainty. Companies want to know what's going to be there for a long time. And to Representative Gardner's point, you know, this is part of our legacy for our kids and our grandkids. But part of also the dialogue that has to take place is there's got to be a fundamental understanding of do you try and capture everything as much as you possibly can today in a basin, in a resource play that is still world class. I think what you need to do and think about is how do you develop a tax and royalty system that is going to be there for a long time and establishes a protocol that is robust for all kinds of fields. Now the question then comes in is how are these fields going to be played? How? What kind of development scenarios can we think about?
Excuse me, got some more questions for Representative Dick, and then we'll continue.
Okay.
It's on my list. Representative Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just flashing back, you mentioned earlier about the gas liquids, and you referred to the 40% efficiency, and I think we're referring to the Fischer-Tropsch process. It's over 60 years old. But at the end of last session and the beginning of this one, we did have a presentation from Alternative. There might be newer methods of gas to liquids, and I certainly that the only way this might not be huge, but it would be, I think it does speak to maybe means of addressing heavy oil and the viscosity in the pipe. So I think we need to keep our minds open to all options, not close them off. So I just wanted to mention that although I don't have expertise in that, I really saw, I get some, became very interested in that, and I think we need to explore all possibilities and not narrow ourselves down.
Representative Britt.
Thank you. So I want to go back to a couple conversations or a couple points that she brought up during the presentation, trying to understand really what the true opportunities may be out there for us. You mentioned one area, the offshore area, the 3 miles out, potentially all the way up to 6 miles out. and that we're currently investing in there. Where I want to understand is, how are we? Are we potentially limited out there because of, obviously, you showed your map, and it has the basins. Of course, they go much farther out than just 6 miles. So are there concerns with being able to try to tap some of these potential reservoirs or potential basins that don't recognize the six-mile line or don't recognize the difference between federal and state land? Can we still go in and extract some of that oil, or is there problems with the fact that we're going to go in and then whose is it? Is it ours? Is it the feds? Where do we get our benefit?
No, there's no problem there. That's all carefully worked out as a reservoir develops. That's no different than onshore, the things that we work with all the time, where you have a field and you have differential ownership. In this case, it simply means there would have to be some revenue sharing between the state and the federal government. If Representative Pruitt, through the chair, if I understand your question, which is that a problem? I would not see that as a problem at all. That's easily handleable. Both the legal framework, the principles are there, and the technology is there to do that.
Okay, and then kind of a second question along that. So is there an opportunity in one of the other areas that you were mentioning to kind of the example I can think of is as a little kid that the girl goes, don't touch me, brother says, I'm not touching you. Is there any opportunity to do that with Anwar? Plop it right beside and then stick a straw over and start sucking out of the federal milkshake, I guess they'll say. We have any opportunities there?
That's an interesting question. I have an entire law review article that was written on that subject, and I can get it to you, but you cannot invade, but you can drill right to the line and then drainage, and then it raises the question, would the federal government drill what's called an offset well to protect against drainage? I mean, there's some interesting things that come about. And we do border up to Anwar on the one side, and then I believe Governor Murkowski at one point also was toying with the notion of perhaps on Alaska's tight and submerged lands drilling a well again offshore to force the issue. And I know it's been discussed in the Senate, and I believe, I'm going from memory, but I believe Senator Lisa Murkowski was working on a possibility of a bill to say that if the federal government has permanently put Anwar off limits and said you can't drill, then you're in effect saying that the subsurface estate has no value. What if Alaska could do what you're suggesting, which is go down and directionally drill, and the Liberty well I mentioned is talking about a lateral displacement at least 8 miles out now, so you could do that, and arguably, there's no harm to the federal government there at all because you're producing oil that would not be produced anyway, and there is benefit to the United States because you're helping the nation's balance of payments, reducing our dependence on foreign oil imports, all of those reasons.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's what the commissioner has also referred to is known as the right of capture. And that is that's been done and proven and tried, I believe, several times to the success of the people who have drilled on their land and have removed product from an adjacent property. So it is doable, but you have to be very careful where your bottom hole location is. So it's technically yes, from a reservoir standpoint, yes, from an engineering drilling standpoint, yes. But it also plays into an interesting discussion that we need to have, and I believe it was Representative Peterson was asking what should we be doing to try and incentivize some of those other remote areas. It's no different than if you were a retailer and you were selling a product. We've done just basically the same thing in our most recent lease sale. We worked closely with the feds and put our lands up, some of our bordering lands up for lease at the same time. and the border, the lands on our side of the state side, we actually had very reasonable, much more reasonable entry rates for leasing adjacent lands to the feds to try and encourage some of that very issue. Let's settle up next to that acreage. Let's put it in for a lower sale price and see if we can get people to participate. And the feds did something similar. So it's that cooperative spirit between those two groups that it, you know, you build your initial lease sale to try and encourage the action that you're looking for.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just say the one last little piece. Let's encourage drill the hole. If they want to drill the hole to counteract it, good on us. Then that gives us an argument of why we can be there, too. So.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And Director Barron, appreciate you bringing up barriers to development. As you're well aware, we had a interim committee meeting strictly on this topic of barriers to development. And, you know, our committee, House Resources Committee, was pretty well disappointed that we didn't have the industry come forward and really identify those barriers as being any barriers. So we are in the position of sitting back here saying, well, ice roads or, you know, that seems to be a barrier, but not having industry come and lay that out to us when we have a hearing. Or we talked about shared gravel roads with that or power, those kind of things. And, you know, I really appreciate getting these on the table again, but it's again from the government side putting these on the table. And I hope that in the future, as we have these things before a session, if we have additional interim meetings on this, we'll have whether they're the existing producers or the smaller explorers, we need to know the problems so that we can identify those and try and work on solving them. We've been trying to work on solving some of them, but I just appreciate you putting this as your first slide, you know, barriers to development and how do we do it, but we really need industry to come forward and actually identify some of those things to us. But I guess one other thing that was brought up was about the individual fields or individual companies identifying tax terms and running through all those scenarios and all. How much of a problem, I mean, it seems to be a problem for us because we have those individual companies trying to do those scenarios, but our understanding is that on the North Slope, the working interest owner agreement means that any one of the three big companies can veto the projects. So that even though things may be viable for a particular company, it would go forward. If that doesn't meet the objectives of one of the other interest owners, the project might not go forward. Can you identify for us as if that specific concern is real, and do you know of any way that we can get around that problem?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the answer is yes, I believe that is real, my understanding of that agreement on the slope. And the subsequent question is no, I don't know if there's any way that we as a body can get around that. I also don't know how much of an impact that has been on the development of Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay has been robustly developed. Many, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars of investment and expense money has gone into that field. Those three companies are also working a broader international portfolio of projects, and that's where I think Representative Hawker has probably said it the best, is we just can't be, we have to be competitive. We just can't be economic. Our area of a regime has got to be a competitive area, and we've got to promote not only a lease sale, but also, you know, normal rental sales and rental rates and severance tax basis so that the state is competitive so that those companies, when they do run their economics, our projects become higher on their overall international list rather than lower. So to answer your question, yes, it's real, and no, I don't know what we can do about that specific issue, and I don't know how much of an impact it has been.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki is asked.
Thanks.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm sorry to have to take you back up to the discussion about roads. I wasn't able to ask my question at that time, but you mentioned specifically Badami and Cook Inlet as some examples, and I would add the shale lease areas that Great Bear has taken up because they've said that they need roads, really, not just ice roads, to do that. With all the talk about roads, and obviously funding is some of it, and we've had some proposals for that, is there any statutory change, or is it a regulatory change to allow something beyond ice roads to be built in some of these areas?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the stipulation, we just need to be really clear, and this kind of goes back to Representative Sadler's question about terms and, uh-huh. and you know, barriers that we create ourselves and just lack of understanding. You know, in our best interest finding that we do for our lease sales, one of the historic best interests that was presented to the division was to do exploration. And I want to make sure everybody is underscoring that word, exploration on ice roads and ice paths, for a very good reason. Companies, you don't necessarily want to have a permanent road just to go out and drill a dry hole and then have to pull that road up. That being said, so that became the best interest. The best interest was deemed to have an ice road and ice path. That has begun to become a problem in as much as the drilling season now is becoming shorter. Access to locations, they're farther out. So having to build an ice road is they're longer roads for a shorter drilling season. So we're working through with the industry trying to get them to come to us with ideas in their mitigation plans, in their original plans for exploration. We've encouraged them to come forward and say, I can do this without having an ice road. That is a perfect example of what Great Bear did in their first efforts. They work very closely with Fish and Game and the Division of Oil and Gas to identify sites that were along the haul road on previously disturbed paths and acres. So they are able to actually move in their rig here later on, early next month, I believe, to be able to do exploration work off of existing disturbed soil so that they don't have to build a nice road or nice path. So we've got to be able to work creatively, but what we also end up having is, again, it comes back to the subsistence issues, the environmental issues, and the potential litigation issues. So we've got to work through that to try and not require exploration on ice roads, but have that as a preferred option. And that's what the division is trying to work through with the industry, is let's get that out as a preferred option, but not necessarily an absolute requirement.
So is there any statutory thing that would need to be changed to sort of promote that, or can you work with right now? Do you have what you need to work on that issue?
Through the chair, let me work on that and get back with you on that, because I think there might be something that we could craft that would be beneficial for the state to do that and still protect the other parties. But let me get back to you on that.
Thank you. And I have another question, Mr. Chair. Speaking of barriers to new production and about being competitive, and we've had testimony, I think, from two different people today about the Texas experience and the resurgence and increasing production in Texas. But one of the things about Texas is that they have a reserves tax. And I don't know if there are other places also that do. Is that something that you see any value in whatsoever?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I'm going to do the opposite of what the commissioner did. I'm going to give that question back to the revenue guys.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director, you kind of answered it, but it's almost sounding like you're saying that you would like the legislature to come in and statutorily mandate you to do something that you have the power to the DNR has the power to change, because you do the best interest finding. So, I mean, if we don't dictate the best interest finding has to be ice roads for exploration, that's, you're not constrained to do that. And so am I hearing that
you're asking maybe us to come in and tell you in your best interest finding you can't have that as your highest priority. Is that, I mean, I can't figure out why, if that's within your authority, why we need to do it.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's exactly why I referenced it. Let me think about how to respond to that, because it is within the purview of the division to make that decision. The way that we change the standings in the best interest finding is from information and requests coming from citizens and the industry itself. So when we get a request or an option to look at another alternative, that's when we can go into the best interest finding and make a determination of finding that it is no longer necessary for maybe this specific project. But it is a very clear decision on my part whether or not to use an ice road or to require one or not to. It is the purview of the division to do that.
Just follow up, Representative.
So it wouldn't be necessary for us to have a finding that we are requesting you to analyze the ability of a road, a exploration road instead of an ice road to be utilized for other facilities and consider that in the best interest finding. You can, you have the full ability to do that now.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay.
What I was referring to relative to the slide is, for example, the road to Badami, road to Umiat, West Cook Inlet. I mean, those are that's what the state can do. The state can say we want and help fund or push through permitting and working with the federal government on wetlands and those kind of issues to put in access, which is one of the biggest hurdles we as a state have. The map makers do not spend a whole lot of money on red ink drawing roads for the state of Alaska. You look at a map of Texas or Oklahoma or Wyoming or North Dakota, pick an oil province. It is just scattered with roads that are easy access for anybody to do their work on. That's a huge hurdle for us.
Representative Gardner.
If the federal government has been working on putting together a big project coordinator to help with all the permitting and keep everybody on the same page, sharing information. Have you seen that happening yet, and do you anticipate that that would be helpful in terms of, you know, exactly this kind of project?
Through the chair, Representative.
Mr. Balash, to answer that one.
For the record, Deputy Commissioner Joe Balash, Department of Natural Resources, it is true that the President issued an executive order last year creating a lead for permit coordination, and I would identify that as perhaps two steps forward, but what we're seeing devolve out of that is maybe one step back, where things are getting dumped down into groups and subgroups and micro subgroups on individual topics that are kind of spinning out. In fact, we've got meetings in Washington, D.C. next week to try and unroot some of that and get things back on track.
Thank you.
At this time, Mr. Barron, I know you got a number of slides to go, and I do not intend to miss any of those slides. However, we are well past scheduled lunchtime, so we will adjourn the meeting here. We'll reconvene as scheduled at 2. You'll continue with your presentation at 2. I've already asked PFC Energy to put off their presentation until 3. So with that, this meeting will be adjourned. We'll reconvene at 2 p.m. this afternoon.